Our guest today is Adam Davenport. Adam is an award-winning musician, singer, actor, teacher, and screenwriter. Okay, welcome to the Broke Actors Podcast. Our guest today is someone who matches my own tenacity and will to get things done. Welcome, Adam Davenport.
Hi, how are you?
It's great. How are you?
Well, it is 8:30 in the morning here in Belgrade, Serbia. I think we have a 9-hour time difference. So your day, I'm starting mine.
Exactly. It's 11:35 p.m. here. So that's quite a difference. Okay, Adam, let's jump right into it. So tell us how you were introduced into the acting industry.
Well, I had a couple of starts. I always had an interest from an early age in the creative arts and performing. I was very active in high school, in the school plays. And then when I went to Yale as an undergrad, I had this notion that I was going to study acting there formally. Unfortunately, my parents weren't quite on board with that.
Mm-hmm.
So my father, in fact, said, "Oh, I'm not sending my son to Yale to be a fag on stage. Besides, no one would want to look at you. You're too ugly." So I believed that lie for a really long time. So I instead studied film, and I tried to get my way into the industry through the other side of the camera, through production. So I did that through my 20s. And then I over 10 years worked for and with an actor, Melissa Leo. And so she was one of many mentors I've had as actors. But I think when I was working with her as an on-set assistant, I would go with her from set to set when we were traveling. And so I would help her get off book when she had to learn her lines. So I would just be running lines with her in the hotel or in the trailer, wherever we were. And one day she just offhandedly said, "You know, if you studied this, you could do this." So she seemed to notice a natural ability, if you will. And so I, at her encouragement, I moved to New York City from LA. How old was I? I was 30 years old.
Okay.
So I started later. I found the cheapest hole-in-the-wall apartment in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn, that I could find. A playwright rented me a room for $300 a month.
Wow.
That allowed me to focus full time on acting. So I, that fall of 2015, I started going to open calls to every audition I could find in backstage. I got a role in the chorus of an opera in Manhattan in the ensemble, and I was paid for the whole job of, I think, a $300 stipend or $250, something like that.
How long was the job?
How long was the job? 2 months.
Okay.
$100 a month stipend, something okay. Like that. That sounds about right for starting out. And then I got my first agent in New York for acting, but I really didn't have experience. The only experience I had were the I guess you could say the amateur productions from college that I had done. I'd never studied any formal techniques or scene study, anything like that. I had on my own, read some books, Because I was interested in acting also from the point of view of directing and wanting to have that vocabulary so that I could know what I'm talking about when talking to an actor. But still, the best way to learn is through doing. And I had quite limited experience. So at any rate, this agent that signed me really just signed me off of my pers he thought I was handsome, and he thought coming out of a school like Yale that I could have some success. So he perhaps overconfidently started sending me out for series regular auditions and
Wow.
leads and plays and things that I was quite frankly not prepared to do. I naturally would work as hard as I could on those auditions, but I had no technique to work from. So later, and but I'm even thinking like my very first audition was series regular for HBO's The Deuce, like 9 pages of sides. Quite like, when you're starting out, you need to for things that match your experience. Like, frankly, one or two line co-stars would have been more the right idea. But I was not very good, admittedly, in these early self-tapes. And so I knew that, and I knew that I needed to just get into any class that would take me, and also that I could afford. So I studied with a number of teachers in New York while I took any job that I could get. The great thing about having rent for only $300 a month is that I could literally be a full-time actor right away and be auditioning every day. I would wake up at 6 a.m. and then take the hour and a half train ride into Manhattan to sit in the non-equity line for these plays or productions, and then have a general audition. And so I primarily did theater, and then I would get commercial work or no to low budget independent projects, thesis films, anything I could. And then within a year, I started, I would put together a reel. And so then a manager signed me, Bill Tresh, who actually was Melissa's first manager in New York. And he also shaped the careers of people like Viggo Mortensen and Sissy Spacek. Then he had a better sense of where I was. So he submitted me for the types of roles that I was appropriate for. And so then in year three, I finally joined SAG. I was eligible to join SAG because I booked a co-star, a one scene co-star in the HBO show High Maintenance. And yeah, that's from that same summer. I got my equity card. I was cast in an off-Broadway production called Naked Boys Singing, and that was on 42nd Street, and it's literally what it sounds like, naked boys singing. So it was myself and five other young guys, singing and dancing our hearts out in the buck. So that was a nice job. I wouldn't say that I'm a musical theater person, but what I liked about the show is that it gave me a chance to play different characters in different scenarios. They're kind of like, the numbers are kind of like vignettes, and they kind of reminded me of the sketch comedy work at in Saturday Night Live. One thing that I skipped over, that before I had actually had taken one class in improv at the Grambling School when I lived in LA. That was kind of like me starting to have one foot in exploring, like, oh, can I do this? And And that was the year before I moved to New York. So had I stayed in LA, I probably would have continued with the Groundlings path. But yeah, just the basic foundation of the yes and I think is really and really important tool, not just for improv, but for any type of acting. Always receive what your partner gives you and not ignore it or deny it. So yeah, I would say now I'm what 7 year, I mean year seven from that initial decision to move to New York and to pursue this full time. COVID shaped that trajectory for me a lot. I was assistant directing a play in New York when everything shut down. And so 6 months into lockdown, I was quite restless in New York because for me, New York isn't the same without an active theater scene. And so I moved here to Europe, to Eastern Europe, and I started an acting school, International Acting Studio or TIAS, and I got my certification as an acting teacher last year. So that's really has been my focus on being a hand in the development of other actors. And I think one thing I've really have learned is that the training never ends. Just like going to the gym, acting is a muscle. And I think there's a false belief that if you do go to conservatory or you've studied acting formally for 4 years, that your training is done. It's not. That just gives you a foundation to start. But if you're not actively developing that part of yourself on a day-to-day basis, you're actually deluding yourself. I like to use the analogy of if you trained in the gym for 5 years but then stopped going, that 5 years is not going to serve you in this moment now. So
Absolutely.
I learn. You also learn by doing in class, and you also learn. I learn from my students. I learn from observing them. We're all peers. We're all interested in the same thing of the truth and how acting and the characters we play can be an instrument of empathy. So these are things that I can't say that I thought about much or at all in year one. I think in year one you're hungry, you want the job, you actually think you can do anything. So you probably that blind naivete or optimism. You put yourself in scenarios like I did in year one of going out for things that you're not right for at all. And then once you know yourself and you also know where you fit in the industry, you can carve out a niche for yourself, and you also know what you're understanding very well what your type is, because I find that's a big difference between working on the stage and working on camera. Whereas in the theater, there's more latitude of the types of characters you can play. And for film and television, I do feel that the majority of the industry works in cast according to type. So you're also going to advance further if you understand that and you know how to navigate yourself. Because you're also then helping casting solve the problems they have of having to cast X number of roles and usually a very limited amount of time. So you also then begin to understand how you fit into this infrastructure or microcosm and also understand it at a level of storytelling too, in collaboration and not just being narcissistic and going into this being like, oh, I want to achieve this, or my success as an actor is predicated on celebrity or fame, mm-hmm. or winning awards. And that's shifted a lot for me. I'm 37 years old now, and I'm quite happy, I'm quite happy playing lots of small roles in different things. I think if you were to ask me that 10 years ago, or when I was just starting, if that something like that would look like a successful career for an actor, I think I would be confused, because I would be trying to imitate or point to what the, you know, this idea of celebrity, for
instance. Yes.
So I think if you're a working actor in any climate, but especially this one, I think you're doing well.
Awesome. Okay. Something you said about you having the hunger when you were in year one. How important do you feel, aside from being in class and always working on your craft, is the admin part of the acting business?
The admin part of acting is very important. I mean, you're essentially, you're running a business as an actor. You are your own brand. So what this means is maintenance of headshots. You know, are you, because your headshot, it needs to be an authentic representation of who you are. I think that's one thing that people miss easily, because they look at it from a standpoint of vanity. So a number of casting directors I talk to regularly complain about that the headshot is submitted, and based on what they see, they invite someone to send in a self-tape, and then they get the self-tape and they're like, who is this? it doesn't look like the person in the headshot. So either it's been extremely retouched, or it's too old. It's a 3 to 5 year old photo, or even sometimes we change dramatically every year. So that's one thing we need to be on the up and up about, keeping your IMDb, your website updated. A lot of people don't have a website or one centralized place where you can, casting or a producer can look at what you've done, see a bio, see a showreel. You'd be surprised how many actors are auditioning but don't have a showreel, or it's a really outdated one. So these are things that are really more important than scrolling on Instagram. Or another actor trap that I see that I'm always harping on my students about is posting things that they think is going to make people interested in them as an actor that have nothing to do with acting. You know, so it's this notion of trying to keep up with the, I don't know when exactly that shift happened, that all actors started trying to imitate, you know, the Kardashian lifestyle, mm-hmm. or something like that, and posting like what you had for breakfast. No, you're never going to get a job based on, you know, any of those things that are being posted on social media. In fact, they can be counterproductive, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that always triggers me, especially when I see that someone who I'm coaching, you know, participate in a behavior like that. So yeah, the administrative, it's knowing where to spend your time and prioritizing that time well. And I think actors, the ones that are successful have found a system that works for them. But I think by and large, actors, we tend to be lazy. You know, we think we don't,
Absolutely.
we're not great managers of our time. Our schedule might be like, oh, yeah, I had a coffee, and I went to the gym, and maybe they submitted themselves for something on the breakdowns, or I talked to my agents. Maybe there was an actual, like an hour of actual physical work done. And then their attitude is, oh, I'm tired. I'm going to take a nap. I'm so tired. But
That's funny.
that's a not uncommon mentality. And whereas if you know if you're running your own business, if you're an entrepreneur, if you're a small business owner, which you are as an actor, you know the typical entrepreneur works 12 to 14 hour days just on their business. And I think if actors spent that same amount of time on their craft, on the business of acting, they would see their results would shift dramatically.
Now, since social media is such a big part of today's culture, how would you suggest a actor utilize their time on social media to help further their career in a way that's not damaging?
Use it minimally or not at all.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't see how it serves people. I mean, you can have an account and there can be great, you can use the devices and technology for a source of information. I enjoy following certain casting profiles. There are people that use their accounts really well and they offer great information. They might also post castings for roles that are harder to fill, that they have a wider search for. But outside of that, I think an actor could post when they're working on something, let people know that they're working. That they are they something or something that they have worked on is about to be shown so people can tune in and see their work. But outside of that, I think people tend to post too much because they feel they get caught into this deluded belief that because they're an actor, they need to be seen. And I get it. There's an underlying psychological impulse to want to seek validation and to, you know, there's I know for every actor that is a shy one, there's probably four more that are extroverted, right? So and enjoy the attention. I think that is natural, but I think that seeking a validation and wanting the attention should be redirected. Because I think that impulse can overtake the work itself.
That makes perfect sense, and I agree completely with that statement. As a acting instructor now, and someone who is still actively having a career of your own, have you ever experienced for yourself or with your students the term imposter syndrome?
Yeah, I don't think that ever goes away, unfortunately. I think you just have to you become better at managing that when the self-critic, when the voice of the self-critic pops up in your mind. I think the most recent time I had imposter syndrome was a year ago when I was undergoing my certification for the National Alliance of Acting Teachers. There was a group of 12 of us in my peer group, and I was really intimidated the first few days because I was the youngest, teacher there. Everyone else, they were, you know, they've been perhaps teaching for 10 years. They were in their 40s, 50s, or 60s even. Maybe had even written a book on acting. So I was, at one moment, I was like, what am I doing here? Why am I part of this? And I would be, as a result, I was very, very quiet and not as vocal as I, you know, I am day to day and offering my insights into things. I think we have to just know with imposter syndrome that you always want to counteract it with an affirmation.
Okay.
If the self-critic shows up and says you're on set and you, let's say you have a co-star and you're on set one day with Meryl Streep and you have lines in the scene with, and you're like, imposter syndrome. Oh, I'm going to be terrible. What am I doing here? Why did they cast me? Everyone, you've just gone through hair and makeup. You're like, everyone's staring at me and no one likes me. They're like, who is this? You just give yourself an affirmation and say, they chose me.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, for the role. I was cast. I've been preparing for this for X amount of time. And I'm going to do my work. That's just one small example. So I think you just have to, and then over time that voice becomes smaller or weaker and less frequent too, versus, you know, like on a daily basis,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I think the imposter syndrome where I see it come up too is sometimes when I'm coaching actors, I can see that they become suddenly very, very insecure and then they shut down. And what that does is it limits your ability to access your instrument in any kind of spontaneous way because you're just operating out of your fear, which puts you in your head. And that's not a place to create from. So that's my, I would say if actors also do some relaxation before they do any work.
Oh, yes.
That people miss that. I see people who try to, they show up here to coach or to tape and I ask them, have you relaxed? And they're like, no. And I'm like, get in that chair. Or get on, semi-supine, get on the floor and, you know, lay on your back for 15 minutes. And so I think that helps too of just getting in the body. In general, for acting, we want to stay out of our head.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where all the things that aren't helpful, tension, et cetera, they tend to live up in the head.
Now for your Yale thesis program or assignment, you directed a film, correct?
Yes.
Did you write it as well?
I wrote it, produced it, edited it, directed it, yeah.
And you had a pretty all-star cast in it as well. Can you tell us about that project?
Sure. Midnight Sun was my thesis film at Yale for the film studies major. I shot it on 35mm. There was no program for 16mm or 35mm production at Yale. They were only equipped for digital production. I think they had like two XL1 Canon cameras on the entire set, and it was very frustrating to be able to practice production because the whole school every week when always was trying to reserve.
Right.
And so just me being my 21-year-old ambitious self, I was like, well, I'm going to screw this. I'm going to shoot on film. And so I got a grant from Panavision, and they gave me the cameras and well, one camera. They gave me one camera and it was a Panaflex and the lenses, and I shot on short ends. And what short ends are what when a production completes filming, whatever film is left, like strips of film, they can resell it at a reduced price back to Kodak, and then those short ends are can they can be sold or given to film students. So I did that. We shot it on 10,000 feet of short ends, which is hardly anything at all. What that meant is that for a film that's essentially 25 minutes long or 21 minutes, we had a 2-to-1 shooting ratio. So we can never do more than two takes for anything. And so yeah, I had a pretty I had a great the thing, interesting thing is about the cast went on for Midnight Sun to do many other things. So April Grace went on to be in Lost and Joker, and she plays a lot of character roles. David Harbour is now on Stranger Things. I saw him in a play on Broadway, the revival Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and that's why I approached him. My short Jack Mulcahy, he was in the Brothers McMullen, and he's on the SAG board presently. And then Melissa Leo, I almost said a young Melissa Leo, but a young no, she'd already been acting for many years, but Melissa Leo, I wrote her a cold letter off of seeing her in 21 Grams. And this was before Frozen River, before The Fighter. And so she plays a very different type of character than what she usually plays, gritty, hard type of in Midnight Sun, Rita is a housewife who is quite soft and has a problem with prescription. With her prescriptions, she's married to a man who's a sex predator, and so she becomes addicted to Ambien, and so that she can not look at what's happening in her home. So the character is a pretty fragile one, and that's what intrigued her to do it. That it was different from something she'd done before. And that kind of sparked our working relationship. I finished the movie, and then one day she called me and said, "Hey, I shot this movie, Frozen River, that I think I'm going to move to LA to promote it. Just to, look for the next phase of work. And so I'm going to rent this house, and I was w thinking maybe you would be a good roommate. What do you think about that?" And I just graduated from Yale, and I thought, well, this kind of sounds like Sunset Boulevard to quite but why the hell not? Let's do it. So we were roommates first, and then we started working together on other things. For Frozen River, there was no budget, so to say, to promote her for an Academy Award. So we did a grassroots campaign of our own. A lot of that consisted of me sending emails, anonymous emails to, like, Academy members or members of the Hollywood Foreign Press or any just getting them to see the movie. 'Cause Classics had organized a number of screenings, but it was a tiny little movie at the time. So,
Now, was this the short or the feature for Frozen River at this point?
recorded feature. She had already shot the short.
Okay.
So by this point, when I was living with her, the movie had been bought at Sundance, and this was just to get people to see the movie in theaters and generate a conversation about Melissa's performance. So then the fighter came along. She didn't think, well, the offer for it came along, David O. Russell wanted to meet with her. There was an early draft of the script. She didn't feel like she was right for the role of Alice. She thought she was too young, for one, because Christian and Mark, I think, are only, they're less than 10 years older than her. And she'd never seen any of David O. Russell's films. So I said, oh, let me show you Flirting with Disaster. And so what made her decide that she would maybe do the movie or made her more open to working with David is Mary Tyler Moore's performance in the movie. And if I can recall, Mary was doing some like ridiculous things in the movie. Like there's a scene where she's chasing Ben Stiller around with like a piece of like cheese. And yet it's like completely, it's over the top, and yet it's grounded in the circumstances of that. And oh, and then I think there's another scene where she's wearing like a push-up bra and she's talking about like her bra. And so Melissa was like, oh, well, if Mary did this for David, then maybe I should be more open to doing this role. So I remember we were in fact watching the movie together on my bed, and she was, we were just laughing through it. And so she decided to do the movie, and then there was a lot of buzz about Melissa's performance, but I think this time we were like, can we go for the win? And so we kind of, this time we had a little bit of a budget. And so we took out ads on the back cover of Vanity Fair and Hollywood Reporter, and also ran ads on online, I think on Awards Daily and Jeffrey L. What's his name? Hollywood Elsewhere is another blog we ran some online blogs on. And so I was essentially her David Axelrod. She did the photo shoot of this, now I guess you could call it the infamous Consider campaign. It's set, so it featured her in a faux fur outfit. There's one of her at the pool, and there's another one of her leaning forward defiantly, and it just says "Consider." It doesn't, and it just says nothing about the fighter or best supporting actress. It doesn't even say her name on the ads, and it's featuring her kind of glammed up. So there was this idea of reminding people that she can change herself, and she doesn't just necessarily play gritty, scrappy women, but she could glam herself up too, because I think that was one narrative we were playing too, while on the red carpets and promoting the fighter. She worked with a different makeup designer and hairstylist who really made her look quite elegant, like a star. Because I think that was something she'd always resisted for a long time. So at these premieres, people were really like, wow, like really like knocked out by her presentation there. So she was playing into that persona of herself. I think another impulse where that came from is that Christian, the other actors in the movie, Christian, Mark, and Amy, were they had opportunities to talk about their work in the media and do magazine covers and such, she was told that she was too old, that she wasn't relevant
Wow.
To do anything like that. So we were also following impulse or inspiration from Betty Davis.
Who took out the ad.
Got the ad and said, you know, two-time Oscar winner available for hire.
With her home number in the...
So we were following that, and I think that was the inspiration. And so, yeah, not everyone understood it. I think there was some backlash, but then I think that backlash corrected itself because a lot of people came to her defense and said, it's so funny now that bad people were critical of that, because now now that self promotion is nothing new. I mean,
right.
2011, social media was not really a thing. People were not running. Consider at like now you can go on Instagram or Facebook, and during awards season, all this stuff will pop up on your phone, and you're not even looking for it. You're like, I'm not even in the Academy. Why does this stuff keep getting thrown in my face? Okay, I would consider it, but I'm not a voter. So now that's oversaturated. But so in some ways, perhaps she was a little bit ahead of her time and taking matters into her own hands. Luckily, you know, that it worked out. Also, we had no idea when we bought the ad space, she had not yet won all these precursors. She hadn't won the SAG. So I think that was one question too from people, that she was so far ahead of everyone else in the race that maybe some people questioned whether it was necessary. But I think it's okay. I think it's okay. If you've been working for decades and, you know, working on Frozen River, she's paid only $100 a day. If you're in a pay grade where you're seeing that you're earning less than your peers, I think it's okay to, and you're in contention for something such as an Academy Award, I think it's okay to want it. And I think it's okay to, I think everyone wants it. Set false humility or false modesty. Oh, well, I'm just happy to be nominated. I mean, that's true at one point, but everyone is fantasizing or visualizing their name called.
Right.
And of course, off the grid, they're all having conversations with their reps saying, what can they do to position themselves for a win even.
Mm-hmm.
That's why people hire publicists and have, you know, pay $5,000 a month for campaigns such as this. Just I think they try to do it under the pretense that other people are doing that work for them. But generally, I think a lot of that desire has to come from the artist initially, because if you weren't interested, you wouldn't participate in any of it.
Now, aside from Melissa Leo, you've developed mentorships with other actresses and actors throughout your time in this industry. Who else have you built those lasting relationships with?
Well, Elfrey Woodard. Also, a lot of these actors, the relationship started from me writing a cold letter to them and reaching out to them. So Alfre Woodard, same situation. I always had a dream of mounting Eugene O'Neill's Long Day's Journey into Night with an all black cast. And so I wrote her a letter and said that she was always my first and only choice to play Mary Tyrone.
Mm-hmm.
And if she would be open to it, could we put together a reading of the play? And so I sent a letter. One day I got a text like thanks for your letter. Let's do it. And so I was confused, and then it said like Alfrey, and I was confused. I'm like, at first I thought it was a joke. I was trying in my mind trying to recall, who did I tell someone that I wrote this letter? So I was like, why would she, I've never talked to her before, why would she text me? And so I called like from my an office number, not from the number I got the call on. So she answered. I was like, oh, okay. So then I said, can we meet for a coffee? And so we met at Le Pain Quotidien, and she agreed to do it. And then I put together a cast for the reading: Lawrence Fishburne, Terrence Howard, Chino Rivera, Laz Alonso, and we did it in my living room. At the time, I was renting a house in Benedict Canyon, so we did it in my living room. And then she attended some meetings with me, and we tried to get the play on its feet. Stephanie Elaine was attached to produce it for a while. Like many things in development, it just remained an idea in development. So we didn't get too far with that. But I did some other readings with Alfrey. She came over and we read Streetcar Named Desire together. And then I asked actors who were much earlier in their career to read some of the other roles. Oh no, but that's not true because Garrett Dillahunt was Stanley and Wayne Knight was Mitch. So yeah, Alfrey's been a long time mentor and colleague, and who else? Sally Kirkland has been in my life for a long time. Similarly, someone who comes out of the actor's studio like Melissa. And
And you two are a member of the Actor Studio?
yeah, in 2012, I became accepted as a director into the playwright directors unit of the studio. So my interview was with Martin Landau, and what that branch of the studio does is in the spirit of Elia Kazan, who was direct. Teaching at the studio and also directing new plays at the same time, the PD unit is trying to develop the next generation of theater writers and directors. So new plays get workshopped at the studio, they get put on their feet by the directors. We're encouraged to use the studio for as many of the members as possible for our cast, but of course we can cast outside of the studio. So yeah, I developed a few things that were done as stage readings, so I got to work with other studio members like Francis Fisher. Yeah, I joined in LA, and then when I moved to New York, I just continued going to session at the studio in New York, what was originally started before they opened the LA branch. So yeah, it's interesting because I at an early age had access to people at a high level that I maybe I took it for granted, but I never was really, deferential or like starstruck or like any of those think moods that might be easy to find oneself in when you're placed in the same room as someone. I mean, I had a movie that I wrote that was briefly set up at Fox where the table read was, there were a lot of players there, Giovanni Ribisi, Michael C. Hall, Jason Ritter, Matt Bomer, Audra McDonald was attached briefly. She did not attend the meeting though. Faye Dunaway wanted to go
Wow.
project, and I talked to her a number of times. And yeah, I think at that so. But I do think maybe one thing that instilled in me was just to be quite pragmatic about all this, that I saw realized from people at the high level that this is just simply their jobs, you know. So what I did not feel that the star persona of these people, if you will, I just saw human beings who had worked on their craft for a really long time, and they could exist in the same space with you, and they could be. And so there was no pretense at any of these meetings, even if I was having an initial, let's say, coffee with Giovanni Ribisi to talk about the script. And I had very limited experience. Like, you know, it's incredible to think that someone like him was open to working with a newcomer like myself at that time. So
I understand that completely.
I do find that the further along people are, in many cases, not all the cases, but it does, the more humility you'll see. Usually it's that arrogance you'll see in someone who is maybe not as experienced or earlier in their career. And the relaxation that I talked about being so pivotal to working, I think the person themselves becomes more relaxed too in their overall being.
Oh wow, you just given us a mouthful, especially in the area of really navigating and pushing for your own career and not holding back or having any kind of reservations about what you can bring to the table, which I think a lot of actors have when, especially when they're first starting out, is I'm not good enough, or why would these people want to be working with me of all people that they can work with?
Well, you might not be good enough if you're not training every day, you know.
Very true.
So you have to pay when you hear the voice, you have to pay attention to it, but also ask yourself why is that voice saying that? If you have a 10-page self-tape and you only started working on it the night before, and you also haven't done your script analysis and you don't know the given circumstances, and then you're having that moment in that moment while the camera's on you and the reader, and you don't feel prepared, that's real information that your inner voice is telling you, I'm not prepared for this moment. That's different than doing your work and showing up and that voice still popping up. So you also have to ask yourself why am I thinking this?
Okay, one last question for you. For a brand new actor who's considering coming into this business and they're unsure if it's the right thing to do or where to begin or how to start, what advice would you give to them?
Be in class, be folk, like. You need to, when you're starting out, you need to build your community. So find gain access to the best teachers that you can work with that foster an environment where you're also in class with other actors who are just as hungry or motivated as you are, who are doing good work. You also want to look at when you're finding a school or studio, what are the students doing, or the people who have recently studied there? Are they working? Are they? I think people focus on the wrong things. People start the number one question that when I do consultations with young actors, they ask me, how do I get an agent? Rather than how do I become a better actor, for instance. And so what I've realized is that when you focus on the first thing of just being a good actor, the other things will fall into place. My role in Knives Out 2 came to me essentially. A casting director heard about me. I didn't go out looking for that. There wasn't even a breakdown that was posted for that. They were very secret about it. The casting director asked me to come in and put myself on tape for that. And then I forgot about it because I was working, was directing a play in Copenhagen, and then I found out they wanted to use me. So that's another thing that people are obsessed with. So when I had that job, that then the vultures descend and they were like, oh, where's the breakdown for that? How can I find that? And it's same thing with my agent here. They found me. I was working on another job project here, and the costume designer said, oh, I have to introduce you to this. My husband runs an agency here. You have to be a client. And so took a meeting and signed with them. I what so there wasn't the emailing of the reps sending the material. I think there can be a value to that, but I think a lot of people get obsessed with doing that. What I realized, what shifted for me in the last 2 years, I just realized I just need to do my best work, and the other things that I want, they'll show up. So, because I think sometimes we get obsessed with doing things, we want instant gratification. So we don't realize that this journey is a marathon. It's not a short distance sprint. So in year one, it took me, where am I at now? So 2005, I'm at the 7 year mark for being in this actor journey full time. It took 6 years to get my first role in a studio film. It took 3 years to get my SAG card. So it is a process. So a lot of people have this idea that they're going to be series regular in year one or two. That's not realistic. Now in year seven, I had just the other day an audition for series regular that I actually felt prepared for versus in year one, where I had no idea what I was doing. Yeah, you have to be patient with the process and be patient with yourself. And I think if you're just starting out, making a game plan for yourself, making a what actionable goals can you achieve in this year, and then make a 7 year plan too. Okay, so I'm gonna do these things in year one, but I have this idea of what year five will look like, year seven. But then, and that's your bigger picture, but then work moment to moment, day to day, to take actionable steps to just focus on year one. So what I tell a lot of people in year one, I'm like, don't even think about an agent. You just need to know what you're doing.
Absolutely. For those who want to follow with your journey or become a student of yours, where can I find you?
Well, there are two accounts that for the school, the International Acting Studio on Instagram. There's also a website, the International Acting Studio dot SE. I set up the company in Sweden, so that's why it's a Swedish website. And for myself is Adam Davenport Official. On Instagram or Facebook, I'm pretty easy to find. So I'm happy to talk to any actors at any point, at any stage of their career. I coach actors from just beginner level to well-established actors or actors who are popular here in Europe. So everyone's working on different things. Just like when you work with a trainer in the gym, they can work with someone who's an advanced, intermediate, or beginner. I welcome all levels. I'm happy to talk to anyone, even if they're not interested in class or they're studying with someone else, but they have some problem, or they just have a question about acting. I'm a total nerd about acting. I'm looking here on my shelf. I have like 12 books on acting that I sometimes find that I'm rereading parts of it, and nerding out. And sometimes my other teachers that I've studied with some time ago, I'm reaching out to them again, and I'm asking a really specific question, like, oh, when Buddha said this, she later said something else years later. How do you reconcile that? I think I love just talking about acting. And so anyone who shares that enthusiasm, I'm happy to engage in them in whatever way.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being a guest on the Broke Actors podcast.
Oh, thank you. Great to talk.
You've been awesome. This has been really, really informative. I think people are really going to love this episode.
Oh, just edit me because I tend to ramble. I'm a rambler.
That's okay. I'm going to edit. I'm going to do a good clean edit on it. Hold on, let me stop the recording.